Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibi. This week on Culturetopia, NBC's new drama, Smash, brings Broadway's backstage drama front and center, from concept to auditions, then rehearsals and premiere. Ever since the file-sharing site Mega Upload got shuttered, similar sites such as Mediafire and RapidShare are trying to prove they're legit. And a pair of longtime friends are about to launch a new show on Comedy Central about their shared experiences as the biracial kids of single moms. But first.
One morning, many years ago, a little boy in Brooklyn named Peter woke up to an amazing sight. Fresh snow.
After breakfast, he put on his snowsuit and ran outside. The snow was piled up very high along the street to make a path for walking.
That's Reading Rainbow's LeVar Burton reading from the groundbreaking book The Snowy Day by Ezra Jack Keats.
Crunch, crunch, crunch. His feet sank into the snow. He walked with his toes pointing out, like this. He walked with his toes pointing in, like that. Then he dragged his feet slowly to make tracks. And he found something sticking out of the snow that made a new track. It was a stick. A stick that was just right for smacking a snow-covered tree.
This year marks the 50th anniversary of The Snowy Day, which, when it came out in 1962, was the first major kids' book to feature a black protagonist who wasn't a caricature. Ezra Jack Keats won the Caldecott Medal for his work, the highest award for a children's picture book.
Well, the first page is the hook. It grabs the reader. There's a beautiful two-page spread of Peter in his pajamas looking out his window from his bed into the snow. The city is covered with snow.
That's Deborah Pope. She's the executive director of the Ezra Jack Keats Foundation. And as she explains, the book brings to life a magical moment some children get to experience.
When you realize, one, you don't have to go to school, and two, you get to play in this world that is all yours. It's all yours. The snow is there just for you. And you can see that. You can see that expression in Peter's face.
The one thing that is never mentioned in the text, Deborah, it just doesn't seem like it's a big deal at all, but in fact it was at the time, is that Peter, this boy Peter, is African-American.
Yep. Yep.
Why wasn't it ever mentioned?
Because it wasn't important. It wasn't the point. The point was that this is a beautiful book about a child's encounter with snow and the wonder of it, and the difficulties, the being rejected by older kids, the realization that snow doesn't last, it's not forever. This is not about color. This is about childhood.
He thought it would be fun to join the big boys in their snowball fight, but he knew he wasn't old enough, not yet. So he made a smiling snowman, and he made angels. He pretended he was a mountain climber. He climbed up a great big tall heaping mountain of snow and slid all the way down.
This is a visually beautiful book. It's very simple. The art is very simple. It's collage-like. Peter is obviously central in this book. There are all these images that are now iconic. You know, Peter in this red costume, his brown skin against the white snow. Was Ezra Jack Keats trying to make a statement? Was he consciously trying to make a statement when he wrote this book and made Peter an African-American?
This book, it's hard to answer that question because part of the answer would be yes and part of the answer would be no. Yes, because he said, well, all the books he had ever illustrated, there had never been a child of color. And they're out there. They should be in the books, too. And so he wanted to put a child of color into his book. But was he trying to make a cause book? Was he trying to make a point? No, he wasn't. He was writing a book about a child. Some of the criticism that he received had to do with the fact that he didn't mention that this was a child of color.
I mean, at the time, this was 1962. This was quite controversial. Some African Americans, like Langston Hughes, praised Ezra Jack Keats, sent him a letter praising the book. But others, civil rights activists and others, felt that this book didn't go far enough.
They were worried. This was, as you pointed out, it was a tumultuous time. It was a time in which the African American community was fighting for its place at the table, was fighting to be heard. And here we have this book. And in the past, when white authors had written about black characters, it had not done well. It was not good. It wasn't good. And so their reaction was, I believe, defensive. And then they realized, because of the way it was embraced, because the reaction that teachers and parents and children, because of their positive experience and reaction to the book, was overwhelming, the criticism subsided. It was no longer necessary that the book say, I am an African-American child going out into the snow today. They realized you don't put a color on a child's experience of the snow.
He picked up a handful of snow, and another, and still another. He packed it round and firm and put the snowball in his pocket for tomorrow. Then he went into his warm house. He told his mother all about his adventures while she took off his wet socks. And he thought and thought and thought about them.
This character, Peter, is inspired by a real person, right?
It's inspired by an image that he cut out of Life magazine in the early 1940s, a strip of four photographs of a little boy, an African-American boy, who has been chosen to receive an experimental vaccine in Georgia. And this kid is like a little dollop of sunshine. In the first frame, he's just beaming out at the camera. He's so happy. He's been chosen. He's going to be given something special. He's a little boy. In the second frame, he's beginning to offer his arm. He wants to know, well, is this going to hurt? And the third, he's really got his arm out, and he gets the vaccine. And in the last frame, he's so hurt. He's pulled his arm back in to him, to his chest, and he's looking out at the camera with such quizzical pain. How could you have hurt me? And he, Ezra, didn't know why this series of pictures moved him, but he cut it out. He kept it with him for 20 years. And when he was given the chance to make a book of his own, that's when he realized why he had chosen to keep this picture with him for so many years. It was this child who entered the world with such joy and had to deal with the pain that very often comes.
Of course, this book went on to win the coveted Caldecott medal. How did children react to this book?
Well, children embraced this book. Kids who grew up in Iowa or in Florida, kids who never see snow. And so Ezra got tons of mail from kids with pictures of Peter, of the snowman, of the snow angels. And perhaps most movingly, there was a teacher wrote into Ezra saying, the kids in my class, for the first time, are using brown crayons to draw themselves. These are African-American children. Before this, they drew themselves with pink crayons, but now they can see themselves.
That's Deborah Pope. She's the executive director of the Ezra Jack Keats Foundation and a childhood friend of the late author himself. You can see some of the illustrations from The Snowy Day and hear the rest of LeVar Burton's reading at our website, npr.org.
While he slept, he dreamed that the sun had melted all the snow away. But when he woke up, his dream was gone. The snow was still everywhere. New snow was falling. After breakfast, he called to his friend from across the hall, and together they went out into the deep, deep snow.
Oh, Let's follow up now on last week's mega indictment, a case that shut down the website megaupload.com for copyright infringement. The Department of Justice is calling this one of the largest copyright cases ever brought by the United States. NPR's Sammy Yenigun went to see how Mega Upload's shutdown is affecting piracy on the web.
It seems like it's still pretty easy for college student Bobby Azerbaijani to find whatever music he wants.
So all I gotta do is go to Google.com, and it's called Smoke Ring for My Halo.
That's an album by guitarist Kurt Vile.
And let's just stick in Mediafire.
He's used Mega Upload before, but that site's gone. Now he's using Mediafire, one of the many sites on the internet where people can share all types of files.
And you go to Mediafire.com, click download, and it's counting down 8 minutes.
Sorry, Kurt. It took Bobby Azerbaijani less than 30 seconds to find your record and download it for free. In the 15 minutes that I spent at his apartment in College Park, Maryland, we found links to another album and two HBO TV shows. Now, Bobby Azerbaijani doesn't know who put those files there, but Ethan Kaplan pays attention to this stuff as VP of product for Live Nation, and he has a hunch.
I think it's most often a fan. The person that uploads the HD digital satellite rip of the latest Office episode, it's not somebody trying to make money, and it's not some like pirate in a back alley of the internet trying to diminish the importance of the television show. It's a huge fan of The Office that wants everybody to see why they're a huge fan because of this amazing show.
But that's not to say there isn't any money to be made off of illegal content. The Mega indictment points to two primary sources of income for Mega Upload: user subscriptions and advertising.
Congratulations, you won.
People, trust me, you haven't won anything. And don't click on the pop-up swarming the download sites. They're like a black hole of advertising. Now, a file-sharing company wants content that's going to pull eyeballs towards these ads.
Any editorial or content-based website always wants to be the first and the only place to get something, because that's how you become a destination.
Mega Upload's Uploader Rewards program paid the people who put up the most downloaded content, says Live Nation's Ethan Kaplan.
And so certainly incentivizing people to do that, it can be seen as inducing piracy, but there also could be seen as, oh no, we're just inducing people to use us first for whatever it is they want to use.
After Mega Upload was taken down, other file sharing sites like Mediafire and RapidShare tried to distance themselves from Mega Upload's legal problems. RapidShare spokesperson Daniel Raymer says they're different because they don't have a rewards program right now.
We believe that this was quite an incentive to upload popular content, which pretty often could be copyright protected.
Raymer says he wasn't surprised that Mega Upload was shut down. He claims RapidShare's been fighting copyright infringement from day one, and that pirated content only takes up a small portion of hosted files. Other file-sharing sites like FileSonic and FileServe scrapped their rewards programs and stopped users from sharing files with each other. But even with the shutdown of Mega Upload, Live Nation's Ethan Kaplan doesn't see this one prosecution wiping out online piracy anytime soon.
Has it disrupted it before? When Napster was sued, and when YouTube was sued, and when VO was sued, and when all these other people were sued? I always like to say water finds its own level.
And Kaplan says, at the end of the day, if it's there and it's free, people will take it. Sammy Yenigun, NPR News.
Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele are a team, a comedy team. Both are biracial, half black, half white.
And so we actually think that we're particularly adept at lying, because on a daily basis, we constantly have to adjust our blackness.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know.
Like, I mean, to terrify white people.
Yep, to terrify white people. That's one of the main reasons. And then,
because, I mean, with our voices now, we sound very white. We are not intimidating anybody we talk.
Yeah, we sound whiter than the black dude in the college a cappella group. That's how white we sound.
NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports on their new sketch comedy series, which premieres on Comedy Central next week.
You can learn a lot about Key and Peele in a sketch they do in which Jordan Peele impersonates President Obama.
I just want to say that I know a lot of people out there seem to think that I don't get angry. That's just not true.
And Keegan-Michael Key plays Luther, Mr. Obama's anger translator.
Luther, first off, concerning the recent developments in the Middle Eastern region, I just want to reiterate our unflinching support for all people and their right to a democratic process.
Hey, all y'all dictators out there, keep messing around and see what happens. Just see what happens.
Watch.
Keegan-Michael Key paces back and forth, flails his arms. Sometimes he puts his face right into the camera like he's about to punch it. As President Obama, Jordan Peele is unflappable.
I just want to say to my critics, I hear your voices, and I'm aware of your concerns.
So maybe if you can chill the out for like a second, then maybe I can focus on some, you know?
Key and Peele say the idea came from a few different sources. First, they're fans of early Saturday Night Live, and one of their favorite sketches was the fake TV news.
If you remember Garrett Morris, and they say, and now for the Association of the Deaf, Garrett Morris will be doing the announcement. And then Garrett Morris would scream at the top of his lungs.
Our top story tonight.
Our top story tonight.
And so that was something we had talked about that we thought, wouldn't it be nice, you know, if we could find a way to finagle Obama's nature and use that as a nugget? You know what I mean? How would we get someone to interpret what we know he really wants to say?
They were even more inspired to write the sketch when a congressman shouted, "You lie," during one of President Obama's speeches.
The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegal.
Key and Peele say it bothered them that Mr. Obama barely reacted.
For him to have that much composure, it's
right.
Like, you don't have, no, not after that. It was really a burr. Jordan Saddle, he's like, come on, brother. If there's ever a time to get down to business, do it. How are you just going to put a finger up and keep talking regular?
Right.
Come on, man.
But, you know, that's kind of course, what we love about him, too, is mm-hmm. that he's so, you know, he's so even measured. He's so together. He's almost Spock-like
yeah.
in his logic and wisdom. You know?
And that Spock-like nature is something else about the president Key and Peele admire. Peele thinks Mr. Obama was the best thing to happen to black nerds everywhere.
Up until Obama, it was basically Urkel and the black guy from Revenge of the Nerds, Lamar. We had no role models. So he made us cool.
And they say he made it easier to be biracial. Jordan Peele grew up in New York. He was raised by a single white mother. Keegan-Michael Key was raised in Detroit. His mom is also white.
You go to school as a kid, and when your mom comes, and the kids go, "That's not your mom.
That ain't your mama. Why are you lying?"
Which, as a kid, is like, that is a deep insult.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
that's our lifeline is our mom when we're little. So somehow I think that's that expectation at a very young age that we were supposed to live up to something because of what we looked like. I mean, I think that probably invaded our souls and gave us the need to do this comedy on some level.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did anyone ever make fun of you growing up because you didn't talk black enough?
Every single day of grade school.
I still make fun of them.
In one of their sketches, Key and Peele change the way they speak, depending on who's listening. It begins with Key by himself on a city sidewalk, talking on his cell phone.
Because you're my wife, and you love the theater, and it's your birthday.
A stranger walks up, played by Jordan Peele, who can hear what he's saying. So Key changes his voice to sound more black.
But they do have seats that are still left in the dress circle. So if you want to me to get them theater tickets right now, I'm going to do it right
now. What's up, dog? I'm about 5 minutes away.
Yeah.
As they part, you realize that the second guy had been changing his voice, too.
Oh,
my God, Christian, I almost totally just got mugged right now.
I love the posturing of it. I love that it taps into, like, stuff that no one's talking about.
Makisha Madden-Toby is a TV critic for the Detroit News.
How do people perceive you versus who you really are? How you let people perceive you? I mean, all of those things, I think they just brilliantly tap into those things.
Madden-Toby says Key and Peele will fill the void that was left on Comedy Central when comedian Dave Chappelle quit his show in 2005.
Comedy Central needed that voice again ever since losing Chappelle, and I think that they are pretty close to it.
Key and Peele are huge Chappelle fans, but for now, they're not sure their new show will reach as many African Americans as Chappelle's did. A tough crowd, they say.
It really concerns us.
To be terribly frank, yeah. That's just one of the things, I guess.
It concerns us that African Americans enjoy this show.
Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele. Their new show debuts next week on Comedy Central. Sketches include parodies of a reality cooking show, being related to Thomas Jefferson, and the little lies husbands tell each other about their wives. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Penelope Lively was in her late 30s before she began her career writing children's books, and now a thrice-nominated and one-time winner of the prestigious Man Booker Prize. Ms. Lively's 20th work of fiction has just been released. It's called How It All Began, and she explores the capricious role the chance can play in people's lives. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
Penelope Lively's lifetime habit of storytelling began when she was growing up in Egypt during World War II. She spent a lot of time alone and amused herself by making up stories, which often involved embellishing the classics with her own personal touch.
The Libyan campaign in the desert was raging about 70 or 80 miles away, so I sort of rejigged the Iliad and put Achilles in a tank instead of all that nonsense about chariots and spears and this kind of thing.
As the war got closer, Lively's family fled Egypt. They landed safely in what was then Palestine. But in a story from one of her earlier books, Making It Up, Lively reimagines that event tragically. In Making It Up, Lively uses real moments from her own life and fictionalizes them, an impulse that grew out of her own late-in-life musings.
You find yourself looking back over your own life and wondering about where it could have gone completely different. And so this was what I was doing. I was looking at the kind of climactic points in my own life and seeing where they might have gone. So I was writing, in a sense, a set of what didn't happen. I was writing the alternative lives that I didn't have.
Lively returns to this idea of the randomness of life in her new book, How It All Began. But this time, one event sets many lives spinning in unexpected directions.
It's to do with happenstance. It's to do with the circumstantial nature of life, the way in which we get blown off course by unexpected events, that you think you direct your own life, but in fact, of course, it's also being directed by all sorts of external factors that you have absolutely no control over. And I was intrigued by the relation of this to chaos theory, the idea that if a butterfly flaps its wing in an Amazon forest, there will be a tornado in Texas.
The event that starts the chain reaction is a mugging. As the book begins, Charlotte Rainsford, an elderly woman, has been knocked flat to the ground.
The pavement rises up and hits her, slams into her face, drives the lower rim of her glasses into her cheek. She is laid out there, prone. What is this? Voices are chattering above her. People are concerned, of course. Bag. She says, my bag. A face is alongside hers. Woman. Nice woman. There's an ambulance on the way, my dear. You'll be fine. Just keep still till they come.
The fallout from this mugging is plentiful. One love affair ends, another begins. Divorce, bankruptcy, and the indignities of old age all threaten to ruin lives. But Lively brings a light touch to the proceedings, and at the calm center of her story is Charlotte. A former teacher who is fiercely independent, Charlotte has to move in with her daughter while she recovers from the injuries inflicted by the mugger. And as she often does, Charlotte turns to books for solace.
She is, in a sense, acting as an observer, and she's someone for whom reading has always been absolutely crucial. She's been a teacher of English, and this is remains central to her. And so she's thinking a lot about that and about the way in which she is a product of everything that she has read, quite as much as a product of the way in which she has lived.
One suspects that Charlotte Rainsford has more than a little of Penelope Lively in her, and Lively depicts the vagaries of old age with the wit and wisdom of someone who has seen a lot in life.
There is one single enormous advantage of being an older writer, which is that you've been there, as it were. I mean, when I started writing, I remember then thinking, I want to write about older people, but I don't know what it's like to be 60 or 70 or whatever. By the time you're a 70s writer, you have been there, you've been through all the decades, and so that actually is a great help, because you can look back and you know what it was like to have been 50 or 40 or whatever.
Lively says she writes more slowly now and doesn't work as much as she used to each day, but so far she says the writing still comes easily. She may have trouble remembering names sometimes, but language has not failed her. And she says, as one of the few who is reporting from the front lines of old age, she's happy to say that aches and pains aside, there's still a great deal that is hugely enjoyable. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Even
even if you think musicals are silly, improbable, sentimental, and fading, it's hard not to be carried away by a real Broadway moment. Sound of an actress belting her heart out. But the moments that led there can be almost as dramatic. For instance, there's the audition.
Hey. Yeah, thanks. That's all we need.
NBC's new drama Plums, the drama behind the curtain. It's called Smash. The new series is the story of a Broadway musical from the first idea to auditions to the casting couch to rehearsals and, of course, the big premiere. Teresa Rebeck is the creator and executive producer of Smash. She's also a screenwriter, playwright, and a Broadway veteran with the hit play Seminar that's now on Broadway. Ms. Rebeck, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
How do we explain the premise of the show? Backstage drama, West Wing for theater folks?
Yeah, I think those are both accurate. It's a workplace drama. It's just that the workplace is a musical.
The heart of the premise is all these different lives get thrown together in the interest of producing a musical about the life of Marilyn Monroe. Realistically, a musical on Marilyn Monroe sound like a good idea to you?
I'm a big fan of Victorian novels, and I was thinking that it might be fun to try something like The Three Musketeers, you know, something that could have great songs and action and feathers and sword fights, and that it might be funny to watch contemporary people having contemporary arguments.
Sounds great.
Yeah, it does sound like fun. Maybe we'll get to do that in season three if we last that long. But then the more we talked about it, the more I came to understand what a powerful figure she is. And at the time, I decided I didn't know if I could write a great musical about Marilyn Monroe, but I knew I could write a great television show about people trying to write a great musical about Marilyn Monroe, and that truly is my task. And now I would say I could write a great musical about Marilyn Monroe because I've spent a year thinking about how to do it.
Well, you do get a couple of songs in the first episode.
Yeah, there's a lot more coming, too. Yeah.
And this rivalry between, forgive a couple of stale cliches, but between a real Broadway baby and a corn-fed, wide-eyed girl from Iowa, who are both competing for the lead role, the blonde and the brunette. Let's listen to a duet they sing as they head into the callback auditions.
I'll just have to forget the hurt that came before. Forget what used to be. The past is on the cutting room floor. The future is here with me.
Oh, my gosh, my heart is racing.
That's a pretty good song.
Do you have any concern that, and I say this as a fan of Broadway, to some people, as I don't have to tell you, they would do anything to avoid a Broadway musical.
What are you saying?
Well, it's a little bit, it's like, how many times have they tried to make a television series out of baseball? And the fact is, millions of people like watching baseball. They just don't necessarily like watching TV series about baseball.
Well, probably the right series hasn't been made yet. You know, there's a lot of truisms that get told in television land. And, you know, everybody said you couldn't do a musical on television until Glee did it. You know, I've lived and worked in the theater my whole life, and I know a lot of theater people, and we're actually a pretty interesting tribe. We're like curious and funny and passionate people. And I think that theater really is universal in a lot of ways, and that certainly the yearning of the human spirit to go after a specific dream is something that we all feel, you know, whether it's your dream to be a star on Broadway or your dream to be a baseball player or your dream to write a novel. And, you know, everybody's got something they dream about. And this is a show about people who toss caution to the winds and threaten to ruin their lives in pursuit of their specific dream, which is rather beautiful. You know, I think theater, especially the musical theater, it opens your heart with joy at its best.
I use the word sentimental in the introduction. Do you think of this show as sentimental?
Not at all. I was going to take exception to that, Scott. I think that, you know what, TV can be sentimental, movies can be sentimental, novels can be sentimental. And yes, can musicals be sentimental? Yes, they can. But I wouldn't brand the form as such. I think that it's really one of the great American art forms, you know, and, you know, there's extraordinary grace and joy to be found in the American musical, in the good ones.
One of my favorite scenes is when the actor playing the lead songwriter, Christian Borle, is talking to his partner about why he doesn't want to work with the director who's not a nice man.
He would have had to have a complete personality change as well as a sex change for me to even consider it.
Well.
But don't well. Oh, don't even well. Well, well, what?
Well, he's really talented, Tom.
You know, a lot of people are talented. We are in an industry which is lousy with talent. Is it too much to ask for kindness, too? Am I a crazy person because I still expect people to be, if not lovely, at least civil in this terrible business?
What is there that is so distinctive? And because you've written for television shows, and I gather NYPD Blue, which certainly was a big success, and one of the incarnations of Law and Order. What is there that is so distinctive and irreplaceable about writing for the stage, and especially Broadway?
Well, I find it unimaginably beautiful to see language and humanity and lights and sound and all come together in this moment of storytelling, which is so potently in relationship to the audience, the presence of the audience. And I do think that if the task of art is to create community, which I believe it is, then theater does it in such a immediate and electrifying way for me. I like listening to lots of people laugh at once, one of my jokes. I do, I know.
Yeah.
I like communal joy. I think that in many ways theater is a lesson in empathy, that when theater works at its best, your heart is moved by the trials of or joy of somebody acting a story out for you on the other side of the stage lights. And sometimes I think, well, that's just, it's in my DNA. It's where I was born, you know.
Actually, I've been given to understand you were born in Cincinnati.
Yeah, I was. They don't know how I got there. Seriously. When I said I wanted to be a playwright, I thought my mother was going to have a heart attack. I mean, it was a pretty unusual thing to want in Cincinnati.
Ms. Rebeck, thanks so much. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Teresa Rebeck, creator and executive producer of SMASH, speaking from New York. You can find a streaming link to the first episode of SMASH on NPR.org.
When the season's over, the play won't end.
Because a baseball diamond is a girl's best friend.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia was produced by Michael Katziff and executive produced by Sarah Saracen. I am Netta Ulipi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.